Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel says his new Defense Innovation Initiative will find creative ways for America's military to stay the best in the world. Dan Gouray is vice president of the Lexington Institute. He writes that Secretary Hagel and whoever winds up replacing him are wise to remember the story of King Canute and the waves when it comes to innovation at the Pentagon. Now, Dan, thank you for being on the program today. I have to confess, I know far more about Katrina and the waves than I do about King Canute and the waves. So I'll need you to give me the thumbnail for context before we move forward, Dan. Thanks for coming on today.
Oh, my pleasure, Francis. All right, so King Canute is being told by all his courtiers, he's an old English king from way back when, that he's all-powerful, he makes the sun rise, the moon set, et cetera, et cetera. You know, he's just terrific. So he takes his whole group, goes down to the beach, as it were, and he says, okay, if I'm as great as you say, if I can command all things just, you know, because I'm the king, I will command the tide to recede. So he stands there until his feet gets wet, making the point that just because you say it so, and certainly just because your courtiers say it's going to be so, don't make it so.
All right, and so that's where you start, under the title DOD Cannot Command Industry to Go Forth and Innovate, and you take the Defense Innovation Initiative as an order for contractors to provide more innovation. Why do you think it's an order and not just an initiative that the Secretary wants to get started or wants his successor to start now?
Well, that's very fair, because it's not just this so-called initiative, which is an attempt to find things to do in innovation. They have, the senior leadership of the Pentagon have been trumpeting this for months. We want more innovation. We expect the contractors to be more innovative. We want them to use more of their own money on innovative activities. Why are you guys making such profits? They claim the profits are high, which they're not. And why don't you kind of plow some of that back into interesting and innovative stuff?
You write, you cite this quote from Secretary Hagel's announcement. This initiative will invite some of the brightest minds from inside and outside government to assess the technologies and systems DOD should develop over the next 3 to 5 years and beyond. What's to pick about that, Dan?
That's what they do all the time. They have all kinds of organizations, and I mentioned some of them by name, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, the Defense Science Board. These are all set up to do this continuously. If this Defense Department isn't looking out 5 years and isn't going out to the best minds in and out of government, then fire the lot of them and find a few people who will.
So this work is being done then, or should be being done, in these organizations that you cite in this piece. Is it possible that this is just an extra effort to put together, as I said, an initiative that may connect the more deeply embed the contractors into these organizations that are looking at this already? Or is there some difference in this Defense Innovation Initiative that will produce potentially a different result?
No, in fact, my article says precisely the opposite. Now, they've created this new steering committee with the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the heads of the intelligence communities and scientists, and it becomes a cast of thousands all getting together in these big, you know, confabs to decide on what's innovative. It's the worst possible way to do it. You want innovation, you do two things. You get off the contractors' backs. You tell them, come on down with the good ideas, and if they, you know, even seem halfway reasonable, man, we'll fund them. And then you sort of stop doing all the regulatory and requirement reporting and control over intellectual property, and you let a thousand flowers bloom. The key to more innovation in defense is to get defense out of the innovation business.
So, but the flaw in your theory there, as I see it, and it's not your flaw, but you say the Pentagon should say, if you bring us something really cool, we'll fund it. They don't have the money, is at least the claim that we hear when people go out to speak in front of groups or they go to the Hill. We don't have an R&D budget anymore. We don't have as much money as we need to do it.
Well, I mean, in one sense, that's fair. Their money is being cut, and in particular, the money for acquisition and R&D is being reduced. But they still have, I don't know what the number is, you know, over $100 billion a year in procurement and R&D. There's a lot of money out there. The real problem, number of problems. One is that they have to have a validated requirement. Well, you know, the trouble is you say, wait till I have a validated requirement. In many cases, the validated requirement comes sort of years late in the process. When you have a software cycle in the commercial world that changes every 6 months, and you have a requirement cycle in DOD that changes every, 5 years, get the problem with being innovative?
Yeah, the matchup there is not really good. You cite two stories in this, two examples in your piece. Tell me those examples and why you think they're significant.
Sure. One was Sikorsky, which is a helicopter maker, that on its own, out of its own pocket, it said, we're going to do a radical design in part to see if we can jumpstart the whole industry, be innovative, and in part because we want to give our own engineers a big challenge for doing something different and innovative. And in a couple of years, on its own money, without all the nonsense in oversight and testing and everything else that the department did, it came up with a really, you can find it online under Sikorsky Helicopters, called the Raider, a really neat, lightweight, helicopter that goes faster than the current stuff we have, operates better, flies higher, all that kind of stuff. And the department basically said, no, we are going to take another ponderous look at the question of a new Scout helicopter. Second one was Textron, and Airland Enterprises, put together, in some cases out of kind of parts that were lying around from other programs, a lightweight, low-end fighter that particularly is going to be good for the export market, but we could use it for a variety of things, trainers, light attack. You know, you want to go chase ISIS down, maybe you don't do it with an F-16 or an F-15, maybe you do it with one of these. These companies did it in a couple of years, which is a tenth the time it takes to build an aircraft under DOD, for a tenth the price, and they put actual airplanes on the ramp.
And you write, without a requirement, these innovative platforms are not likely to go far in today's Pentagon. It strikes me that this is the kind of innovation I imagine that Secretary Hagel and his successor will want to see through the Defense Innovation Initiative. Why do you think those won't get very far?
Well, because, again, back to things like requirements and the idea, you have to validate a requirement, and now you get all the special interests involved, and, you know, these guys did it on their own. Well, how do we know this thing is, they're going to check on the pricing, they're going to check on the intellectual property, they're going to check on, whether OSHA requirements were met in the building of this thing, on and on and on and on. And meanwhile, the Army, for example, has gone through half a dozen failed helicopter programs. You know, we tried to remember the Comanche. Anybody remember the Comanche? That was going to be the big new thing, neat helicopter, and they spent gazillion dollars on it and couldn't bring it to fruition. Sikorsky does it in no time, out of its hip pocket. You want innovation? That's the way to do it. That's the way we did it with the U-2. That's the way we've done it. Well, that's the way the Wright brothers did it.
You cite a couple of problems in this piece that you see that are making it harder for companies to do this kind of thing. One is what you call a mania for competition. The second is LPTA, four letters that strike fear into the hearts of Route 66. and then a third is, you write, the demand for certified cost and pricing data on commercial items. And the reason for that is dramatically different, you write, than what people see in the private sector.
Yeah, the problem here is the Pentagon has said it's part of their innovation effort. They want to get new players in from the commercial market and rely more on commercial companies, those that haven't been doing defense business for forever and ever. The problem is they have a totally different accounting system. They do, you know, generally accepted accounting practices. They don't record. They do not keep track of certified cost and pricing data. They get a good price from what they think is a good price from a sub. They don't say, is this the best price or is somebody else getting a better one? But that's the question the government keeps asking. And they don't ask it of the sub. They want that prime contractor, whoever it might be, a Boeing, for example, to certify that all the way down that supply chain to the guy making nuts and bolts, that Boeing got the very best price possible. And in some cases, in a lot of cases, these companies sell parts and wires and you name it all over the world and haven't a clue. They don't record it, and they haven't a clue. They don't even have a system for getting that kind of data. You want to increase the cost and delay the innovation process? Put in government accounting and reporting requirements, and you're guaranteed to quintuple the amount of time it takes.
Dan, just a couple of minutes left. What is performance-based logistics, and why do you think it's getting short shrift inside the Pentagon?
Great question. Performance-based logistics basically puts the onus on a company for the performance of a system or a part, like an engine on an airplane. Most commercial airlines, all the ones you're flying, you know, everybody's flying today and tomorrow and all this, they contract for the amount of engine time. They say, look, Pratt & Whitney, GE, whoever, Rolls-Royce, I want that engine to stay on that wing and perform adequately for, let's say, 10,000 hours before it has to be taken off. If it's less than 10,000 hours, you pay me, and I will agree on a price. If it's over 10,000 hours, or if Boeing or GE or Pratt & Whitney can do it for less than the agreed-upon price, they keep the profit. That creates an innovation incentive. It's a driver for innovation because the companies all want those engines to stay on forever and reap the profits of never having to do repairs. So the companies get all the advantages of having airplanes that never go into depot maintenance, essentially, and the companies make money. There are some government programs. The C-17 we maintain, Boeing does, with a very long-term performance-based logistics contract, and it's saved, by, I think by some estimates, $4 billion. Why isn't every major platform program done with a PBL? That's the question that should be asked to the secretary or his replacement.